fighting for America.
You've got tremendous love for this country, Kevin, and the people of Idaho, and anybody that has had a chance to be able to get to know you, even just listening to you on the radio, knows you got a heart of gold, man, and we all appreciate it.
Fighting for Idaho.
Hey, thanks again, Kevin, and thanks to the IDO. You know, we appreciate you and the community, obviously. Appreciate you guys all the time. I'm just another one.
Fighting for you.
Everybody isn't Kevin Miller, and I'm not just saying this. I said this behind your back. You are one of the best in the entire country. I know that for a fact. But you are an exception, sadly, a big exception to what our industry's become.
Boise's Mr. Right, Kevin Miller in the morning.
Well, Heidi, the check's in the mail for that one.
On 580 KIDO, Idaho's first radio station.
Good morning, Kevin Miller here at 580 KIDO. We're joined by the chairman of the Republican Party, Stephen Yates. Mr. Yates, good morning.
Hi, Kevin. Great to be with you.
Good to have you with us. Of course, also DC Intel, DCAdvisory.com if you're looking for, DCIAdvisory.com if you're looking for some international political risk management. We want to make sure we get your paying job in there.
Excellent. Appreciate that very much.
You know, here we are in and around September 11th. Could you tell us a little bit about your experience that day?
Well, needless to say, it's something that I will never forget. It was, as has often been described, a cool, crisp, clear morning in Washington, D.C. I'd gone in early to the office, which for me was the Eisenhower Executive Office building across West Executive Avenue from the West Wing of the White House. And I had been getting preparations ready for the Vice President to received Prime Minister of Australia, John Howard, on Capitol Hill, who John Howard was going to give an address to a joint session of Congress, and also to receive the Chief Secretary of Hong Kong, just a courtesy exchange of views, also going to be up on Capitol Hill. So I'd gone across West Executive over to the West Wing to talk with some of the VP's staff over there and do a quick pre-brief of what we had in mind up on the Hill. And when I went back across, and I got back into our national security office, a military officer turned to me and said, sir, you have to see this. And I thought, okay, you know, there's always news on the TV, and there's the latest banner going across the bottoms. You know, I thought, okay, what is it? And it showed the smoke in one of the towers. And I thought, oh, my goodness, that's horrible. Can you imagine how difficult it would be to get fire squad up there to help people? And you know, started talking about things. They're explaining to me that it was a plane. I thought, how in the world does someone fly a plane into those two towers? I mean, isn't there air defense? How did someone accidentally do this? And then as we were talking about this, a second plane went straight through, and obviously it was the very clear indication this was not an accident. This was an attack, and we had a bigger problem. There were warnings about other hijackings. There were concerns about the White House complex itself being a target. Alarms started going off. Heavily armed men came up from the basements, and they repeated one simple word over and over, evacuate, 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 because it takes humans in shock and stress multiple times to actually understand one English word and move. And so we evacuated the White House, left a very, very bare-bones staff with the Vice President down in the Emergency Evacuation Center, Operations Center. I walked half of the way out of the District of Columbia from the White House to the zoo before I was able to get in the metro and then ride the rest of the way to the Maryland suburbs, where I was able to connect with my family and let them know I was okay, and watched with a lot of the rest of the country with horror as the towers collapsed and the Pentagon attack was covered, the concerns about the flight that went down in Pennsylvania, and just the tremendous shock. And I remember being there. My daughter was really young at the time, only approaching three, but was, you know, sort of catching the images on television, sort of get the basics of what's going on and is this real. Then went through that evening. Got up early the next morning, suited up, and went into the office and just went right to work. The President was in the Oval Office and in the hallways there greeting staff back to our offices, and just got busy about the work of how do we respond? How do we understand what happened? What do we need to do at home to help the country and what do we need to do abroad to keep the country safe? And it just really went off in a sprint from there.
What was that like for you to brief the president and the vice president that day?
Well, I was evacuated pretty quick. So it was my experiences with the vice president that morning were brief and happy and somewhat excited to get up to the Hill and do the meetings that we had planned. It was all positives. And I didn't see the vice president for the rest of the September 11th. On September 12th, in a way, it was very, very reassuring to see both of them back at work. But remember, in the immediate aftermath, due to the continuity of government plan, the vice president and the president were not known to be in the same location at any given time. So we began having the vice president go to undisclosed locations. And when the president would travel, the vice president might be in the West Wing for continuity of governance. But that day it was reassuring to see people back at work in many ways. We needed to basically get about our business. That's the only way you can sort of put past you the shock of what you witnessed.
Well, and for you yourself, you not only had to be like the rest of us, Mr. Yates, here at 580 KIDO, but then you had to tell the vice president, the president, you know, how do we respond? What are the options? What's going on? What's the reaction?
I was a part of the team that looked at what we called the arc of instability. So there were a team of people who really were responding white hot to who is Al-Qaeda, what's happening in Afghanistan, what kind of military plans need to be drawn up immediately, what do we need to be doing with adjustments to staffing, requirements and intelligence, deployment of troops to pre-position, a whole host of things. And the arc of instability was this grouping of countries where we knew there had been terrorist training grounds, where there had been movements of suspects who were Al-Qaeda affiliated. So you had a stretch that went from Southeast Asia in Indonesia, Malaysia, southern Philippines, all the way across India and Pakistan, and then across some of the broader Middle East and Northern Africa, where we needed to look really, really carefully about whether follow-on activities coming, were there opportunities for us to change our government policy now that we had been shocked into focusing first and foremost on this threat. People might not remember, but when we went through the 2000 campaign and for a lot of the beginning of 2001, we were looking at adjustments to major country relations like Russia, China, and India. We were looking at major functional challenges like nuclear programs in various countries that we wanted to negotiate a halt to, missile defense that we wanted to deploy, things like that. So we had a lot of adjustments to make, and so I was in that team that was working very, very hard at how should we adjust our approach to the countries outside of the Afghanistan theater, and then how do we get support for the planned operations. So once the operations were known, several of us were involved in managing the communications or setting up the president, vice president, and other principals to communicate with leaders in allied countries and some leaders in non-allied countries so that we were telling them, here's our assessment, here's the challenge, here's a hint at what we aim to do. And if you're a non-allied country, we'd tell you very politely, don't get in our way. This is a grave U.S. national security concern. This is, and it was a very sobering time in many, many ways, but it was busy, and being busy with the work was in many ways how we coped, and that's, how we pushed ahead.
Mr. Yates, Stephen Yates joining us, chairman of the Republican Party at 580KIDO, talking about his September 11th so many years ago. You're a proud father. You and I have talked about this on and off the air. What one day will you tell your children about what their daddy did and what the country did that day?
Well, that's a good question. And I know we have some friends in the media, Glenn Beck and some others, who have been encouraging parents to find ways to talk with their children about the threats that are out there in the world and the challenges and tough choices our country has to make and the priorities our leaders need to have in order to have a shot at meeting these challenges. I've talked off and on with my daughter since she had some, she had some cognizance of what was going on that day, even though she was very, very young. And She, of course, lived through a lot of the time I was away, and I've tried to explain to her why I was away for such long periods of time. And needless to say, my mind wasn't in a happy place with a lot of the things I was dealing with. And I probably, unfortunately, brought some of that home. So I've tried to talk with her about some of those things. At present, my daughter is 15, and so she's not really that interested in listening to what Daddy has to say. So I'm waiting for her to rejoin interest in family and the past. But occasionally we will see news, and occasionally she'll get an assignment at school that will talk about terrorism, Islamist extremism, what's happening with ISIS and the broader Middle East. All the kids that track any element of news know that there are beheadings that are on video, and I've talked with her about how horrifying it was for me and for my brother to at first witness the Daniel Pearl execution. I still have a rotten pit in my stomach about that whole experience. So I've talked with her some. My son is 9, and talk a little bit about these things, just in my judgment. I don't know that 9 is the age that is really ready for reality when it comes to these things, other than understanding that there are people out there in the world that aim to hurt us, and Daddy and all of his colleagues are working very, very hard to make sure they can't do it.
Stephen Yates joining us, chairman of the State Republican Party. Kevin Miller in the morning here at 580 KIDO. Of course, also DC Intel Advisory, that is his company in Idaho Falls. Now, I know you're building a TV studio here in Boise. Are you going to have a Boise presence as well?
We are. We have an office in the lower plaza of the Hoff Building, and that office contains the television studio. It is almost completely finished with the installation. Most of the things are there. We're just waiting for the high-speed internet hookup to finish and for some of the programming of the equipment that connects with television networks in New York and elsewhere to get programmed and installed. But we're looking at sometime in the middle of the month to be able to do a housewarming or a ribbon-cutting kind of ceremony and invite people to come by and see the facility, learn a little bit about what it is and how it works, and encourage people to avail themselves of it.
Well, Mr. Yates, we appreciate it. We're going to have you on for the hour here at 580KIDO, and we'll talk more about ISIS. I know you've been making the rounds, and I think we're going to ask you, coming up after traffic and weather here, how you do the time management with all your appearances, so we really appreciate your time. Please stand by. More coming up with our great friend Stephen Yates. Kevin Miller in the morning, 580 KIDO. Let's get you to work safely and on time. Good morning, Dave.
Dave Ramsey, weekdays at noon. Now back to Kevin Miller on 580 KIDO, Idaho's first radio station.
580 KIDO, Kevin Miller in the morning. Stephen Yates joining us, chairman of the state GOP. We're going to talk about state politics coming up, but you get around quite a bit, whether it's Greta, whether it's Fox News, whether it's Glenn Beck. Why are people talking to you so much, sir?
Well, I guess it's because I've had an unusual experience in being able to witness national security decision-making at the highest level during some very consequential times. And they usually have a couple of different reasons to have people on television or on programs like yours. It usually has to do with a title that people will immediately understand is relevant to the topic, and hopefully you're able to say things in a way that invite people to understand and maybe occasionally encourage them to take action. So I have been blessed to be invited to be on with people, and I guess I haven't bored them too much or scared them too much, although I do feel a little bad that when I do a morning program and we talk about terrorism and the potential of a nuclear breakout in dangerous countries and things like that, sort of scare the pants off of people at the beginning of the day.
I know. We struggle with that quite a bit here, wake up to what's wrong in the world. So we always want to inspire folks. But having worked at the highest levels of national security in the world, how are we doing as far as this ISIS threat, and how are they different from our foes in the past?
Well, this is a very frustrating topic because I don't think that we have the right kind of leadership in place. And it's not just a partisan judgment, even just on process. And we're hearing more and more Democrats being willing to admit the truth. And even the president himself admitted the truth in acknowledging that he doesn't have a strategy yet for dealing with the problem in Syria, and we're in the fourth year of a civil war there that's spilled beyond its borders. It's just exceedingly frustrating to me because there's some basic elements of how to think about national security challenges that shouldn't be partisan at all. So you look at a threat and you say, can I name and define an enemy? And if the answer is no, then it's very, very difficult to have a strategy that has a shot at success. If you're able to define an enemy, do you have some kind of objective, an end state that you seek, or some position you hope to be able to achieve in managing it? So do you aim to defeat an enemy? Do you aim to roll it back or push it back? Do you aim to deter it? Do you aim to contain it? Just some very basic things. And our current president seems unable to say this about any of the challenges that have come in his years in office. Just very, very difficult for me to understand. And then there's the whole set of questions about how do you aim to execute your strategy? Do you have tools that you are going to include or exclude? He always says it's an all of the above or every option is on the table. But repeatedly with this administration, you have them say what's not on the table. And then they don't say what the tools are we're going to use, or they're very, very limited. And the needle doesn't seem to move. Then there's the simple questions of, are we going it alone, or are we building a coalition? Are allies in the lead, or do we have allies of convenience, if not by treaty, that are going to take up some of the dirty work and will be in a supporting role? Just very, very unclear about any kind of coalition building or management, or just simple things that any real leader in national security and even in business would have to do. And it's just exceedingly frustrating for me, having lived through basically the bejesus getting kicked out of President Bush and his national security team, which admittedly made some mistakes on process and substance somewhere along the way, but was dead serious about following these kinds of processes, coming up with strategies. And they didn't always get it right, but they made adjustments. And presidents before President Bush did the same. And it's unique in this president where we seem to have an absence of any of those normal processes. And that's, like I say, before you get at whether people believe the objective is right or wrong, or the ideology animating the president and his strategy is right or wrong. So it's just very frustrating to me. And the threats today are greater in part because of the absence of any real initiative or any faith that average Americans can have that what we're doing is working and that things will get better if we stick to it. It's just vital that when you face deadly enemies, that our public has some confidence that we know what we're doing and that they believe if we sustain it, we'll prevail.
Here's the scary part, though. When you have Jihadi John or John the Beetle start calling out the president, is that indicative that they have no respect for us, not from a propaganda point of view, but they just don't care? They do not fear us.
Oh, I believe that these kinds of radicalized groups don't fear anything. Basically, part of their initiation is to consider themselves in some ways already dead, and so they don't fear death. And so they can be exceedingly bold and brash in their declarations, whether it's wise, strategically advantageous, what have you, is another matter. America, once duly provoked, can have the most awesome power and influence of any nation in human history. But the question is, what will we be provoked to do? And currently, I think that it is shocking to see these images and hear these kinds of messages. One assassin doing this isn't really an army, but it represents a complete disregard for American power. It does expose, not to just our own citizens, but to allies in other countries, that America at the moment appears impotent against this kind of basically 7th century military.
And yet we spent billions of dollars. You were working with the administration when we did the surge, when we saved Iraq. How can all that training, all that military, all that might be defeated by a bunch of guys, and again, I'm oversimplifying this, sir, at 580KIDO, wearing black pajamas and machine guns?
Well, of course, that assassin is not operating alone. He has sizable numbers with him, and they have significant equipment, which they were able to take in their combat roles in the civil war in Syria, and then they were able to seize the equipment and other wherewithal when they took key cities in Iraq. And we have not lost everything that we invested in that process. It's easy to despair and feel as if all has been lost. These things tend to ebb and flow, and there are indications that elements within Iraq are organizing and pushing back somewhat effectively, but this is not an Iraq-only problem. And this is one of the frustrations I've had when I speak with networks in Europe or debate people who come from this international community. I've always wondered what that international community is, but they tend to be people who hate America, but they criticize everything we do. But they come in with, well, you broke Iraq, and so you have to fix this, and you're responsible for creating ISIS. Well, no. Islamist radicalism, violence, terrorism, all of those things predate George W. Bush. They predate Bill Clinton. These things go back a long, long ways. The Muslim Brotherhood was established at the beginning of the last century. And these things have been cooking for a very, very long time. You have very determined adversaries that, as I say, don't fear death, recruit the downtrodden into their militancy. It is much easier to break things than to fix and govern things. And they're very good at what they do. And we have not been aggressive enough in tracking, infiltrating, and basically making life hard for them. And ultimately, for me, that is what our strategy needs to be. We shouldn't be looking at the extreme of invasion and nation building and things like that, but we should be all about making life hard for these terrorists and those networks and any country that harbors them. And we just, you know, at the very least, we should make it very hard for them to move, very hard for them to access money, make it very hard for them to wake up in the morning confident that they're going to live through the day. They need to be in fear. And, you know, that's I think, is what we need to be active about, and we shouldn't be doing it alone. Allies in the region should be a part of it. We need to have stronger, more sensible homeland security measures here to make sure that the online and community recruitment in our own country is not happening. And, of course, we have to be sensible about our border and immigration processes about students coming. We still haven't really sobered up about people taking flight lessons. It's just in some ways we have left 9/11 so far behind. We've got catch up here and basic catch up abroad.
More coming up with our great friend, the chairman of the State Republican Party here in Idaho, Stephen Yates. Kevin Miller here at 580 KIDO. Coming up, we'll take a look at the news. You're listening to 580 KIDO.
Dave Ramsey, weekdays at noon. Now back to Kevin Miller on 580 KIDO. Idaho's first radio station.
580 KIDO. Good morning. Kevin Miller with you. Stephen Yates joining us, chairman of the State Republican Party. We always want to make sure that we get your paying gig in as well. And it's not a gig. It's a company that does some really great things. Mr. Yates, would you let people know what you're doing when you're not chairman of the state GOP?
Well, there's two things that I'm actively involved in. One is my consulting company that's DC International Advisory that offers political risk analysis to companies the way my business partner and I used to do for cabinet-level officials in government. And then the second thing that we do is we have a nonprofit policy institution called the Hamilton Foundation, where we seek to redefine the center of political debate and policy debate in the country, and we bring the think tank to audiences instead of building a building and trying to invite people in for pastries and chats the way the D.C. tanks do.
It's rare that I find another Hamiltonian.
Well, there's some people that complain about that name, but we have on our website the reason why we've chosen to identify with him. He was a rags-to-riches story. We identify with the rags part, the riches part we're still waiting for. But he filled some very important roles for President Washington and General Washington. And he was key in setting up some key institutions in the federal government, like the Treasury, at the beginning of the Republic.
Let's talk about the state, Idaho. You're the chairman of the Republican Party here. When last we left, you had just been elected. You've been touring the state listening to folks. I was just talking to our friend Dominic Jealous Messino the other day, and he says, I've got to talk to Chairman Yates. I go, well, he's out there listening. What have you learned so far, sir?
Well, it's been very, very helpful to me to be able to go to many different parts of the state and to hear what people's priorities are. been able to talk with several, but not all of our nominees, and been able to talk with our statewide constitutional officers and to basically hone in on what we're hearing from constituents as being their priorities. Of course, how the Idaho economy is going is a major concern, but education really seems to be the policy area that comes up most often. We have many, many people in the grassroots who are anxious about where national education policy has been going and its impact on Idaho education policy. So questions about approaches to testing and data gathering and the whole Common Core basket of issues. But I also hear from a number of people who want to make sure that we're investing in the right ways in the capabilities of our children so that they can be well prepared to move on to college or the workforce. And there's a lot of creative ideas out there too. The Albertsons Foundation and some others in the state have been looking at technical and vocational training avenues to help people get skills for very worthy, employable, and well-paying jobs. My dad is a car mechanic, and several members of my extended family lived out their days taking care of their families and contributing to their community in those kinds of so-called dirty jobs. So it's been really interesting to listen to people's concerns and approaches to education policy. And I'm happy as a Republican that we have a governor's task force and we have people who work in the education field who focus on the whole process and don't just try to zero in on top-line dollar amount alone as somehow being the solution. I think the Democrats are kind of a one-note symphony in that regard, and Republicans have looked more at the role of parents, involvement of parents, accountability to parents, and also the whole education, lifetime education requirement we have in this day and age to be competitive in today's workforce.
Well, let's continue on that level. What is this election about? The gubernatorial election, what is this about?
When I look at it, I mean, we in the Republican Party had our season of competition. No one much paid any attention to the Democratic Party because they are relatively small in our state. And when the biggest of tents has competition within, a lot of people will focus on the differences that come out of that process. But you know, once we're past that season of competition, we have a very sizable network of people within the party who are now have a simple choice between D's and R's in the fall. So really for me it comes down to, do you vote for the party that, that supports faith, family, private enterprise, private charity, and all of those independent institutions in our community thriving? Or do you support the party that seems at every turn to put the government between you, your wealth, your child's education, your faith, the services you need as a family? And I think it really comes down to that. And people can have their differing views about where various Republicans are within, but all Republicans unify behind the need to push back against the Obama-Reid-Pelosi agenda, to be concerned about federal encroachment in our state. And I just don't believe that very many Republicans, conservatives, libertarians, whatever people's chosen titles are going to be open to the idea of the land board, key judicial appointments, and the sovereignty of our state being put in the hands of the party of Obama, Reid, and Pelosi.
And yet you'll have folks, let's start at the top of the ticket, Mr. Belukov, saying that he's all about education. As you know, that is a powerful issue here in the state of Idaho. Everybody wants to help the schools. We haven't figured out how. How much of a silver bullet, if at all, will that be to derail the popular incumbent Governor Otter?
Well, I think you have, on the one hand, a challenger from the party of Obama, Reid, and Pelosi saying that he's going to take an independent Idaho approach to education. Well, that's an interesting question people will need to tackle. And then in his communication, along with his fellow Democrat who seeks to be superintendent of public schools, they speak at great length about education, but they really only talk about one topic, funding. And even with that, they use one statistic over and over and over and don't really address how money is being used within the system and other elements of the education challenge. On the other hand, we have Governor Otter, and he has he's already put in place a task force agenda that consulted with a wide range of stakeholders in our state who focus on education, including people in the education business, but also business itself, Republican, Democrat, every flavor of life in Idaho. And so he has a much, much more comprehensive education agenda by comparison. And I think if people take the time to look, they can find things that they like or dislike in anyone's proposals. But overall, Governor Otter has taken a much more serious and comprehensive approach to education. I think that will stand up against this sort of one-note symphony of repeating, I think, a distorted statistic about how Idaho is doing. People know that there are plenty of Idaho students who come out of the process and are able to score well on college entrance exams, perform well, and succeed in their lives as they go ahead. We're doing many things right. While there's areas to improve, there's one side with a comprehensive agenda and another that just says more money is the solution.
More of the same. Stephen Yates joining us here, state chairman of the GOP. Kevin Miller in the morning. Coming up next, we're going to take a look at the big tent. When we're talking about the state Republican Party, we've got a lot of conservative activists. I know Mr. Yates has been on the road when he's not working, when he's not hanging out with his family, when he's not doing everything else, you know, to try and make sure that, in fact, all sides are heard. And you have a lot of people saying, what happens if the conservatives stay home? Plus, we're going to ask him a little bit. We'll only have time for maybe two questions. We'll ask him a little bit about perhaps Mitt Romney riding again. That and much more coming up with Stephen Yates. You're listening to Kevin Miller at 580 KIDO. Let's get you.
Sean Hannity, weekdays at 3. Now, back to Kevin Miller on 580 KIDO, Idaho's first radio station.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us. Kevin Miller in the morning, 580 KIDO. Stephen Yates joining us, chairman of the state GOP. A couple more issues here. We've got like 5 minutes left, sir. So let me give you as much time as possible. How do you get the conservatives back? Have the conservatives gone, or is that just much ado about nothing when we're talking about this election, when we're talking about reelecting Governor Otter?
Well, there's no question that conservatives have expressed concern about the direction the state is going. And it's good that they have a concern. And we do have a big tent. We have a variety of ideological points of view and policy points of view within the Idaho Republican Party. I have tried to help people to consider the broad national challenges that we face and have that context as we look at where we need to be as a party. So when you're looking at a November 4th election, we have to look at the ticket as from top to bottom and compared to the alternatives on that ballot. And do conservatives really believe that the country that we live in is at great risk or minimal risk at home and abroad? Can we afford to lose time and initiative by pulling back in support of the leaders that aren't 100% what we want, but are 80% of what we need, and allow those who support 30% or so of our interests to sort of clean the palate? There's been a temptation out there that's talked about. I oppose that because I believe the nation is at risk at home and abroad, and we need to be strong in Idaho in finding a way to protect our state sovereignty and have a higher degree of self-reliance here, because I just don't think neighboring states, especially those once we get to the coast, are going to be in good positions in the years ahead.
Let's talk a little bit about our old friend, former Governor Romney, a man who's run. Look, he took on Ted Kennedy, took on John Kerry in Massachusetts. A lot of people forget that. Could it be that Mitt Romney rides again?
Well, there's a lot of talk about that, and I don't think it can be excluded as a possibility. There are a lot of governors and former governors that are out there. There are a few senators that have thrown themselves into the mix as well. I think we're going to have a very, very interesting and competitive 2016 process. The season is not going to be as long with as many debates as there were the last time around. The RNC has taken a good degree of control over when we're going to have our presidential-level debates and make sure that it's good for the party and good for our eventual nominee. Mitt's still a force out there in politics. And there's a lot of people in the state of Idaho that really like him a great deal. But there's going to be a lot of other choices, too. And I'm excited about people having a chance to get to know some of the governors that I've had the privilege to get to know a little bit. When we have governors like Bobby Jindal, Rick Perry, Scott Walker, Chris Christie, lots of others that certainly bring spice to the debate. I think we're going to have a good competitive season. I don't think any outcome can be taken as a given. I don't think the Democrat nominee can be taken as a given either. So we're in Idaho. We're going to have our presidential caucus process. We're going to begin planning for that in January going forward. Hopefully it's good for the state and we draw in top-tier people to engage directly with our voters here. I think they appreciate that.
Well, Mr. Yates, any final thoughts that you'd like to share with us?
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to engage the audience. I am genuinely interested in what people's priorities are, and I hope that they'll feel comfortable expressing the feedback to the party. We can't answer everyone because there's one of me and many of you, but I do care, and hopefully we have a chance to meet and exchange views.
Stephen Yates, we appreciate it. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Kevin. Take care.
Okay, have a great day. Let's get you to traffic now. Only on
the Treasure Valley's exclusive home for Kevin Miller. KIDOAM.com. 580 KIDO. Idaho's place to talk.
Kevin Miller in the morning. 580 KIDO. Our friends at the Big Fox Accountability Bell will be coming up, giving us the latest news, weather, and all the information you need to know to start your day. I want you to start your day here. Tell your friends. Once they listen, they kind of like it. And I know we do appreciate it. So, again, what was I going to say? Yeah, everything you need to know before you get to work, plus your ability to yap about it. That's what we're all about here. You're listening to Kevin Miller on Idaho's first talk station, 580 KIDO.
Serving.